Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
You know your business better than anyone. So when you need finance to grow, you deserve a lender who understands too. Responsible finance providers look at the whole picture, the story behind the numbers, your plan and what you want to achieve. Our fair, flexible finance, decided by real people, not a computer, helps thousands of businesses every year. Find out more at findingfinance.org.uk. Finding Finance is a trading style of the Community Development Finance Association, which is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. A regulated credit broker and not a lender. We provide information only in respect of community development finance institutions and other finance providers, which may be available to you from our approved panel of lenders. Finding Finance. .org.uk.
Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can help you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082.
Out to the east, there came a hard man. Oh, all the way from Brighton. Glory, hallelujah. Caught liver oil and the orange juice. Well, he went into a pub and he come out paralytic. Oh, VP and cider. What a hell of a mixture. Cod liver oil and the orange juice. Sex rears its ugly head now. Does this bus go to the dentist and Pally? Whoa, I'm looking for a lumber. Glory, hallelujah. Cod liver oil.
Oh, me. This is Communities Live.
Because at that time the housing was cheaper.
I know it's not a big city centre, but there's still quite a few shops. I quite like it.
Dog and Partridge on Trippett Lane every other Thursday.
I love the green room just for like acoustic nights.
This is Communities Live.
It's a very big question, isn't it?
We have a diverse society in Sheffield.
I like all the art sculptures.
It's friendly, there's a lot to do.
I really like the Peace Gardens. I like all the little fountains and little areas that you can just sit out and chill in.
Sheffield is a very nice city.
This is Communities Live.
I love Sheffield, yes. Love it. Been here 17 years.
I like Sheffield because the people are very friendly.
This is a large student community, so it makes it like very lively, very vibrant city in that regard, and also very multicultural, no?
And we love the Sheffield people.
Everything, the city, the nature, the outside of Sheffield. It's lovely. Great place.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to Commuters Live here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Chris Adeli here, and I am with...
Jane McPhillips.
John Healy.
So, how are you doing, guys? Thank you for joining me today.
Good, thank you. We've come out of the cold weather, so we're all good.
So, I know, it's what a turn it's been. I mean, all of a sudden, it's been all right, all of us... weather-wise, a couple of days ago, it was really nice and warm, and now we're back to...
winter.
Back to winter now.
Yeah.
Can't seem to make up its mind, can it? Yeah. So, Jane, I want to say thank you again for joining me today. We were talking about neurodiversity before, and we'd like to continue the trend again. So I want to say thank you for joining me. John, it's a pleasure meeting you today, and I can't wait to hear your story. So thank you for joining me. And I want to start with you, John, because we talked to Jane a lot last time she came in, and we were talking about neurodiversity throughout the full show. So what's your story? Tell us a bit about you.
Well, about the neurodiversity bit, or just generally?
Well, just tell us a bit about yourself for starts.
All right, well... I started off as a draftsman working in London, and I did that for 12 years, and then I didn't like it, so I left and I ended up being a milkman.
Right.
And that sort of blew all expectations away, really. I could do whatever I wanted after that.
Sure.
Then I did a lot of self-employment stuff, and then I ended up working with young offenders.
Right.
And did that for 30 years till I retired.
Brilliant. Go on.
And I've been writing books for the past 20 years. I've written 7 books. But the interesting thing is that up until Jane said to me about 3 years ago now, do you think you might be autistic, Dad? And I said, nah, that'd be daft. And then we talked about it and I thought, I think I am. And we just worked out I am. And I'd been seeing a therapist for anxiety 3 months prior to that. And she said, the first thing I put on your notes was autism.
Right.
What that made complete sense of my whole life up to that point, that I'd been chasing something which I couldn't resolve.
Right.
Why wasn't I happy? Why was I always discontent? Why was I always looking for something else? And now I know the answer to that.
Yeah.
I can't cure it, but I can manage it.
I mean, I was saying to Jane before, because I have Asperger's and dyspraxia. I mean, I had known I had a condition called dyspraxia when I was a young age. We didn't know that I had Asperger's until I was in my early 20s, which is a long time. And I'll be honest with you, I mean, when I found out I had dyspraxia, I really struggled with it. Really struggled. And I've always kept saying to myself, and this is how ignorant I was to it at the first. And I've always said that if there was a cure or an operation that could make me right, I would take it. And it took me a few years to actually accept it, because I was getting frustrated, I was angry. I took it out of my family, really, and it worked fair on them, and it weren't fair on anybody, really, because it was like... And, I mean, I was bullied at school, and, it were awful at start. And then I went to a place called Autism Plus, And I was a completely different person back then. I wouldn't talk to anybody. I didn't have the confidence to talk to anybody. And I did a confidence building course for about 10 weeks. And they asked me if I want to stay on and do a course called Health Champions. And it's like building my still confidence building, building myself up as well. And it took me a good while to finally accept who I was. And to be honest now, looking at my dyspraxia and Asperger's, to say that I wanted it cured and have an operation on it, I don't want it now. I don't need it. Because now, it's maybe, I realise it's maybe the person who I am now.
Yeah.
And it took me a good while to figure that out. And I don't think I would be here today if I didn't have that. So I'm really grateful for it now.
And it's about acceptance, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it took me a good while to accept it. And there were a lot of arguments about it, I'll say that, because it was a frustrating thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was very frustrating. I didn't have any friends at the start supporting me. And that was another thing that hit me hard as well. But now, on the flip side, I am really grateful for what's happened.
Yeah.
And because, again, like I say, if it weren't for that, I wouldn't be here today.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to ask you as well, John. How do you feel about having autism?
Well, I feel relieved, because it explains everything that's been the past previous 77 years. It explains why I've been like I am.
Yeah.
And I've had so much guilt over the years because I should be so and so and I'm not. And now I understand why. I know it's because I've got a low mood. That's part of autism.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly chasing dopamine, which is what gives you the lift for serotonin.
Yeah.
And I know I spent my whole life chasing dopamine. Simple as that. And that's got me into so many scrapes.
Yeah.
And, done impetuous things and crazy things because I get a hit from it.
Yeah. And I think another term is that we're all misunderstood as well, because, I was misunderstood. Like, people were saying that I was a very, very nice person or all like that. I mean, a lot of people said that, but, well, it more or less like people my age thinking that I'm some sort of weirdo or stuff like that. Well, that it's, but it's so misunderstood today, and it's, but it's more recognisable now than what it was back in the past 20 years ago now. Because, last time when I had dyspraxia, there was only 2% of the population that was known about it. And a lot of people said, when we told them what it was, we were saying, what is it? What was that? And we didn't understand what it was. And I think now, coming years and years later, it's becoming more popular and more...
more understood.
More understood about it.
Yeah.
So
I was treated for depression for ages.
Mm.
I wasn't depressed. I was just struggling, trying to make sense of what was going on.
Yeah. I completely feel for you, John, because, I was definitely struggling, and I could not understand what was going on with me. I mean, I were angry, I were frustrated. But when I figured out what it actually was, the word, I don't like this word, because it's not a disability for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ability, because there's no such thing as normal. There is no such thing as normal for me.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is different. Everybody can do things differently. Everybody can't do things. So there's no such thing as normal for me. And I'm proud to say that, really. And I want to say thank you, John, for joining me as well.
Oh, no, thank you for inviting me through, Jane. It's great.
So, Jane, we were talking to you about our past with neurodiversity. So tell us a little bit about yours.
So my story is that I discovered that I was neurodivergent after two of my children had a diagnosis. And I think that's a very common experience. Well, actually, it's been played out again here in the generations, isn't it? So I discovered my neurodiversity because two of my children got their diagnosis. Mm-hmm. That made me join the dots and understand myself. And it's through my understanding that's enabled Dad to work out what's going on for him. Yeah. And I think it's interesting when you can see there's three generations here. And actually, each generation is having a slightly different experience because my youngest is 15. And I see the difference in him understanding his neurodiversity since he was 10 compared to my eldest, who's 25, and she didn't know until she was 18. All these different stages in which they found out. Me not finding out until I was in my 40s, done a whole lot of life, but, you know, I've got enough to understanding now to think, right, I want to design my life a bit differently.
Yeah.
And then my dad being your generation, which I think we were saying on the way here, weren't we, Dad, that it just was, there weren't any of these conversations up until, I mean, really, for your generation, still, even, it's a very difficult.
Yeah, it's depression. You're depressed. That's what they're saying.
I mean, how life-changing is it for you to find out that you have autism?
Totally. 100% life-changing, because it stopped me feeling guilty. It stopped me searching for something that I can't find.
Yeah.
I spent my whole life trying to find, why aren't I happy? I've got everything that I want, you know, materially, spiritually, emotionally, I've got everything that I need, and yet I'm not satisfied. I'm looking for something else.
Yeah.
And that something else is about anxiety. It's about avoiding anxiety and dealing with anxiety, which it's a fight or flight. It's there all the time. So now I understand that. I can manage it.
Yeah.
I can learn how to be in situations, and instead of being taken over by them, I can actually control how I deal with it.
Yeah. And do you know what the frustrating thing about the past was? That nobody ever heard about it. that was the frustrating. I mean, a lot of people knew about dyslexia, but we never heard about dyspraxia or autism. And it was so frustrating because it's like, I don't even think the doctors actually heard about it at the time. And it's like, to go through all that and try to explain why you want to diagnose, because it's like, it's part of who you are. So, because it's not just finding out you got a disability or, well, I don't like that word. I really don't like that word.
It's how your brain works, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just finding out how your brain works, how you're wired. Yeah.
It's, I mean, it's fine. It's also, it's not just finding out what's wrong. It's finding about a piece of your identity as well. I mean, that's the main part. And I don't think a lot of people understand that, really, unfortunately.
A lot of people don't have to challenge it.
Yeah.
They're not challenged as to why they're like they are. They just get on with it and do it.
Sure.
And maybe that challenge is what it's all about. That's what you grow from.
You know,
you grow from difficulty and pain, really. And if you don't have that, then maybe you don't grow.
Exactly. You know what, and I totally agree, and I mean, we've got so much to talk about. It's 20 past 12 already. Our time has flown. I mean, it's unbelievable. I think we're going to cut to a little break now. So we're going to play a song for you, John. I want to say thank you for joining me. We're going to play one of your favourite singers. This is Eric Clapton, Tears in Heaven. Thank you.
Yeah. not a shaman or a showman. Ashamed I was selling the rights. I took a breather and decided not to ruin my life. I was conforming to a cosmic design. I was playing to type until I walked back to the garden of earthly delights. I was born to perform. It's a calling. I exist to do this. Shouting and pointing. And by the way, it's Mike Island. Come alive. And by the way, it's time I'll get it right. Oh,
no one will ever understand it, and no one will ever have the last word. Because it's not something you could ever say. So swivel. Sunshine on your face.
Sorry about that, John. I didn't realise we've just finished a latest song, so it's called Blur, Out of Time. And we were just having a little chat about AI. So, I mean, you've just recently wrote a book about it. So tell us a bit about what you think about AI.
Well, I think if we use it as a tool, I think it's brilliant. It's, you know, it cuts a lot of the donkey work out, a lot of the leg work out of things. It can do a lot of that sort of stuff, but it can also make us lazy, and I think we can give over to it and let it do things.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, I was just saying to you, I've just written a book, and I was using AI as a sounding board. So I would give it a chapter and say, what do you think of that? You know, are there any weaknesses in it? And it would come back and give me a tweak and say, you could put an extra line in there or take a line out there. Fine. And then it said, I've written your next chapter for you in your voice. And I said, no, you haven't.
Right.
You will never do that. And it came back and said, fair point, I won't do that. But it would have done if I'd have let it.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to go into that, just let it do it.
You know, it's so frightening because, I mean, it doesn't just take over your, like you say, it could take over our lives. I mean, it's taking over jobs and everything at the moment, which is, it's shocking, really, with how fast it's actually grown. I mean, about 20, 30 years ago, it was non-existent. I mean, it was only an idea in a film. And I think the first time I've actually heard about AI was Terminator.
Yeah.
And that was... And I think he's actually thought of the future, what it could be, hasn't he?
Absolutely.
And, and it's actually frightening when it's actually coming to fruition right now.
Because now you've got AI teaching AI.
Yeah.
So it's exponentially increasing really, really quickly.
And I mean, we were also talking about with it being used in the film industry as well. I mean, the late, great Val Kilmer, who unfortunately died due to cancer, is going to be used in a new film by AI. I mean, controversial as it may say, I mean, I'd like to hear your opinion, everybody, about this. Give you more details later on. But how do you feel about bringing back actors?
I think it's using. I think you said you. That's right. It is. It's using them to make money, really.
Yeah.
I think it's quite. I can't see the. It's not the real thing, is it? It's a copy of, isn't it?
I mean, it's like, I don't know if you watch, go on social media sites or anything, but it's like Martin Lewis, I mean, the money savings expert. And they used his likeness, his shirt, his AI, and they said Elon Musk was presenting a new project, even though it was a fake. a lot of people, unfortunately, fell for it.
I did.
Oh, I'm sorry,
not that one. It was a different guy. It was a big star who was promoting this financial thing. And I went for it.
Sorry,
I didn't lose much on it. But it's so convincing.
It is.
Absolutely convincing.
And you know what? It's true what he says. It's a wild west on the internet at the moment. Because everywhere you go, even if it's like it could be one of the safest sites you could go on, it's dangerous because you don't know what you're going on. You don't know what's real. You don't know what's not real. And unfortunately, nobody's doing anything about it. I think it's one of the most dangerous. The internet is a great thing, but it's also a bad thing, I think, because there's so much danger on the internet, and we need to protect people as much as possible. And I don't see, unfortunately, I don't see much of that happening at the moment, which is a shame, really. I mean, what's your views on that, John?
How long have you got? I mean, I think it goes a lot wider. You know, I think there's worldwide conspiracy going on. I think there's a group that's running the whole thing worldwide.
Do you think it's like the rich are getting richer and
about the elite. And they want to get rid of the majority of people, which they call useless eaters, if you like.
Yeah.
To bring all that. And AI is a great tool for that because it can eliminate a lot of people.
And it's wrong. It's so wrong. I mean, you know, it's... I've been talking to you and I've been talking to Jane as well. I mean, and I've always said this, everybody's got a story to tell. And, you know, everybody is the same as everybody else. You might have got people that call themselves celebrities or royalty, but we're still normal as everybody else, as far as I'm concerned. There's no difference between anybody. And, you know, that's my message, I think. And I think a lot of people might disagree with me on that, but I think there's no such thing as normal or different people. I mean, everybody is different in different ways. So, I mean, that's my opinion on that, I think. I mean, what do you think, John?
Yeah, I think we've all got the same basic things in our personalities. We've just got different amounts of it, I suppose. And some people have got a lot of confidence, some people haven't got much confidence. But I think there are certain people that are born with a talent which other people are...
Yeah.
Like my obsession with Eric Clapton, for instance. All right, I know that's an obsession because that's a neurodivergent thing. But people like that have got a talent, a skill, a natural talent which comes... Not very many people have.
Yeah.
I mean, artists and singers and, you know, they've got that.
Sure.
They've got that something, like actors. You know, top actors are only top actors because they've got that something that people want to see.
Yeah.
If I know so-and-so's in a film, I'll go and see it because I know that their charisma will pull me in.
I mean, I am a huge James Bond fan, so that's my obsession. And I mean, anything that's got James Bond, I'm a collector as well. Because I collect like the model cars, I collect like the Lego sets, cards, everything you can think of. I'll be honest with you, I don't know if you've seen the last film, where No Time to Die with Daniel Craig. I did not like that ending.
Oh.
I did not like that ending. I was upset about that one.
Who was your best James Bond then?
Oh, gosh.
You got him going.
Wow. Sean Connery.
Yeah.
Sean Connery, best one.
I totally agree. Well, Sean Connery and then Daniel Craig.
And then Daniel Craig. Daniel Craig turned it around.
Yeah.
George Lazenby... He were all right, but with him only doing one movie, I wouldn't call him a James Bond, really. Roger Moore, he were very cheesy.
Yeah.
Pierce Brosnan, too suave. But Daniel Craig, I mean, I really like Daniel Craig.
Gritty.
Yeah. But I did not like how it ended. And I don't want to say any spoilers for people who haven't watched it, because... Yeah, it did upset me, the ending. And And I'll be honest with you, I made a complaint about it. But we're not going, we'll not say any more on there.
But who's going to be next, Chris?
You know, I've heard rumours, and I hope it's not true. I'll be honest with you, I hope it's not true. I heard rumours that Tom Holland was in the running.
Oh, no.
Tom Holland was...
Tom Hardy, maybe.
Tom Hardy, yes, definitely.
Oh, Tom Hardy, yeah.
I think Henry Cavill will make a great James Bond as well.
Yeah, but he's been Superman.
Yeah.
And has he been somebody else?
He's been in Superman and he's been in Mission Impossible as well.
Yeah. I just think, can you be Superman and James Bond?
Possibly. I mean, it was,
that's just being greedy on the special front.
Well, it's like, I mean, think of Roger Moore with The Saint.
Oh, that's true.
And, I mean, he was The Saint and that was like a James Bond kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then he became James Bond himself. Pierce Brosnan with Remington Steele. Before he became James Bond. And, I like Timothy Dalton as well. I think he was underrated. Because he was kind of gritty.
Not as charismatic, though.
No.
No, because I can't remember him. Oh, yes, I just got a flash of him then. Yes, I did.
Yeah, I mean, I think his best one was License to Kill. I mean, a lot of people say it was too dark, but it kind of reminds me like the 80s version of what Daniel Craig has done. Because, and I think a lot of people didn't want it to go too dark, but when Daniel Craig did it, it was like a License to Kill, what he did with every single film, because he actually went, not dark, but it was...
More realistic.
It was more realistic, more gritty. And, I mean, there's quite a few names I'd like to see. I mean, like I said, Tom Hardy would be a good one. Aaron Taylor-Johnson, he'd be a great one. Henry Cavill, possibly. I mean, I just can't see Tom... I mean, we've seen Tom Holland, but I can't see it. I just can't see it. And, I mean, he's a great Spider-Man, but for Bond, no.
He's a bit young.
Yeah,
he wouldn't have that life experience that Bond has got, has he?
No.
All those 4,000 women and all that stuff.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think we'll just end up with James Bond now, because we've got another topic I want to talk about, we were talking about earlier, about burnout and meltdown. So, John, can you tell us a bit about your experience, if you're comfortable with it?
Yeah, of course. I was working in social services, and my manager wasn't doing what he should be doing. And I put up with it for a long time, and I was aware that my team were really suffering because of it. So in the end, I told him what I thought of him, and I went off sick. And the head of service came to me and said, "What's the problem?" And I told her. And from that, big changes came, and the teams changed and all that sort of stuff. I had to see a psychiatrist part for Norfolk County Council, and she said, "You've got burnout. In other words, you've used all your energy up. You've got nothing left." And I said, "Well, what do I need to do?" And she said, "You've got to play. You've got to do nothing for a few weeks. Just play. You can't go to work because you can't. You've got no energy. You've got no strength. Your tank is empty."
Yeah.
And when your tank is empty, your brain switches off.
Sure.
So that's what has how I see burnout. That's a big burnout. You can have small burnouts, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I would see.
And what about you, Jane? I mean, if you're happy to tell us, I mean, because it is a topic that we need to talk about. I mean, how do you feel about burnout and meltdown?
So I see burnout and meltdowns as being two different things, personally. And because I am a neurodivergent therapist, a lot of clients come to me with both. And quite often they're having regular meltdowns, as in things become so overwhelming they can't cope with things.
Sure.
And it's like it just the emotion or something finds its way out, or there can be an internal meltdown. And I think if the system in which you're working, living, isn't maybe suited to your needs, I think those meltdowns can keep happening.
Yeah.
And then over a prolonged period of time, I think that can lead to a burnout. Sometimes it's internal meltdowns. So I used to have internal meltdowns where I literally just shut down in on myself. and I couldn't really talk or do anything.
Yeah.
I didn't recognise what was going on, but then my massive burnout happened during COVID, which meant that I couldn't work for several months, and it took me a few years to get better. And that for me is a burnout. But I think it was a sequence of having lots of meltdown scenarios where I was overwhelmed but didn't know how to manage it, or share it with the world. Yeah. I would just be like, oh, I should just be able to do that because other people look like they can just do that. But internally, it was using a lot of energy. And I think eventually, like Dad was saying, my tank was empty. I was done. And my body just went, no. And I see a lot of clients that are coming to see me at that point where they're either on the edge of burnout or they're trying to come out of it. But if their life stays the same, then they're just going to keep going back into a system that creates more and more meltdowns or burnouts. And I think it's very difficult for a neurodivergent person, if everything stays the same, to get well.
Yeah.
I think something big has to change, but it's not, you've not always got the support in order to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And maybe that's, maybe that's the difference. Maybe the difference also is that people who aren't neurodivergent can cope with something and just brush it off, maybe, or just be irritated for a few minutes. Whereas somebody who's neurodivergent are more likely to just crash.
Yes.
Because it's instantly overwhelming. And it could be something which somebody who isn't neurodivergent would say, what the hell are you getting upset about that about?
Yeah.
But it's irrational, but it's so real, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And if you have enough of them, like Jane says, they'll lead to a burnout. So you can get some mini meltdowns and work through them and get past them.
Yeah.
But they could last for days,
sure.
Just the effect of them, because they take all your energy, don't they? They're just exhausting. Mm. And then you feel uncomfortable. You think, well, what am I getting upset about that for? That's stupid.
Yeah.
But it isn't stupid. That's how your brain is wired.
It is, yes.
It can't run, so it's got to fight. But it's nothing to fight.
Yes.
So it's stuck.
Mm. I mean, I want to tell you my story as well, because you mentioned a really important point as well about COVID. And I mean, when the world practically shut itself down due to COVID. And when we found out that we weren't coming back here, I mean, I struggled. And I mean, really struggled. And I've had a complete meltdown when I thought I weren't going to come back here again. We did a lot of work from home. I mean, that was, it helped a bit, but when it didn't help, when you felt trapped in your own house as well. And I'll be honest, I completely had a meltdown after that. And I struggled. I mean, there were times where I wouldn't even talk to anybody. I wouldn't even talk to my own family. I just shut myself in my room, and it wasn't really healthy. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people suffer from that with COVID. I mean, and to say that you couldn't see anybody as well, it was the hardest thing to do. And I mean, like, it just felt to me like everything, I mean, selfish, it might sound selfish, I felt like everything was stripped away from you in one go. Because I mean, this place to me, it's not just my workplace, it's my second home as well, because that's how I feel, because I feel like I am someone here, and you know, that's how I feel. And not only that, it's also the meeting and meeting new people as well, which I would have never have done in 20 years ago. So it's that I kind of missed, really. I mean, yeah, you could talk to people on a computer, great and all, but it's still missing that social contact, I think.
I think, coming back to AI, I think there could be a place for AI as a friend for people who can't get out, people who've got no friends, who find making friends very difficult. I think there is room for AI to be like an artificial friend to somebody, but there's big dangers to that as well.
Yeah.
But I could see how I use it for bouncing my book off, and it's like having an editor sitting next to me on the sofa. Because I live on my own. It's like having a friend in the house to a degree.
I mean, I want to ask you as well, John. I mean, it could be a great thing, like you say, but where do you think we should stop with it?
Exactly, yeah.
Where should we stop it? Because we don't want to go too far.
No. I don't think we know yet. I think we're still working it out.
Right. Because it's like, I mean, it's like we're replacing people with AI, which I think is wrong. Mm. It should be, if you're working with AI, you should be working with AI with the workforce as well. And like I say, it's replacing jobs, which I think is wrong, really. But that's my opinion. But it's like, I mean, it's like we asked it. I mean, what have we got now? We've got computers, like self-serving checkouts. It used to be full of people doing checkouts at one point.
Mm.
But now they're doing like self-services and scanners and stuff like that. And I've also noticed that for anybody that's doing like degrees or, and this is my opinion, I think if you get an IT degree in the computers and stuff like that, the world's your oyster, because every job now requires a computer.
Hmm.
I mean, it's like, I was talking to a surgeon one point. He was a doctor, and he said how he used VR headsets to train doctors in operations instead of using like real life, like a dummy or like that, and doing the operations that way. They're using computer generated games of that, use like VR headsets, and I don't know what to think of that.
I think the way is to we need to keep in touch with our humanity. That's what we're losing.
Yes.
And I think I mean I'm not in any way religious. If people would be religious, that's up to them. But I think over the years it's gone. You know, we've become secular in this country now. We haven't got a strong religion. And what religion gave people was a code of living and a basis.
Yes.
And that's gone. And I think that's very clear that's gone. Now, I'm not saying that religion is the way to do it, but personally, for me, I think there's other ways. It's, you know, being in touch with the universe and being spiritual in yourself and understanding who you are and caring for other people. If you can do that, then AI will fit into that, because it won't take, we won't need it to fulfill us emotionally. What's happening is we've got an emotional void because we haven't got that basic behind us that's supporting us.
Yes.
Going to the church and saying, "What should I do?" That's gone. Now, I personally wouldn't do that. I don't. You know, I'm not religious.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about your book as well. So, what's your book called?
Well, my latest one is called Unraveling.
Right.
It's about a guy who. It's a parody. It's a comedy.
Yeah.
It's about a guy who discovers a spell. And he uses it, and it causes chaos. And as it's undoing, as it's unraveling, AI starts to become bigger and bigger.
Right.
And so he goes into the future through a time machine, to 50 years into the future, and he sees what's happening with AI then, and he realizes that it's not good. Because what's happened is that AI has become sentient. It's become aware of itself. It's become alive.
Yeah.
And so things like toasters get upset, and doors refuse to open because they're having a bad day. And they go, and you know, electrical things are going for counselling. It's silly, but it's got a point to it.
Right.
That's the basis of the story.
Right, and I mean, is it published today as we speak?
Well, at the moment, I've just finished it. I put it on Amazon to get a test copy to see what it looks like.
Right.
And then I'm going to send it to an agent.
Great.
But I've got six other books on Amazon.
And have you got a rough estimate of when the release might be?
Well, it depends if I can find an agent. I mean, it will be on Amazon next week.
Right.
If people want to look on Amazon for John Healy, they'll see it on there.
So watch this space, ladies and gentlemen.
Along with the other six books.
And you know what? We've come to the end of the show. It's quick. I can't believe it. It's almost 1 o'clock already. It's so flown, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's always flies when you're having fun. I mean, I hope you two had a great time, and I want to say thank you for joining me today.
Mm. It's been great, Chris.
You know, I want to shake your hand again, so thank you for joining me. And same with you, Jane. Again, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for sharing your story. Really important to get these out there.
Thank you for listening.
And you know what? I think there's still more to do. There's still a lot more to do, and there's a lot more stories out there that we need to get and eye up a canoe at.
Mm, good.
And, you know, if you ever want to come to the studio again, please do.
I'm happy to, yeah.
Because, I mean, we're always looking for volunteers as well, and we're always looking for people, so... Yeah, please come down. You've got a platform as well.
Don't tell him that, Chris. He'll be here with his guitar next week.
Oh, nothing wrong with bringing his guitar, you know.
I'll read my book over the... Over the
So, right, we're going to come... We're at the end of the show now. So, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you two. So, this is goodbye from Chris and Ollie, and goodbye from...
Jane McPhillips.
And goodbye from...
John Healy.
And we'll be back next week. So thank you for joining me. This is Chris and Ollie from Commuters Live. Bye.